KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. If you use Facebook, you know it's in a seemingly endless state of overhaul. What doesn't change is user reaction. It's usually negative for each change, and concerns about privacy are always right in the fore. Facebook's latest innovation is something that it calls graph search, and here to tell us more about it is Will Oremus, who's a staff writer at Slate. Hello, Will.
Hi.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is graph search?
Facebook Graph Search is the new search function that Facebook announced in January, and they're starting to roll it out to everybody in the United States this week and over the next couple of weeks. It is not like Google Search in the sense that it doesn't just search for anything that's out there on the web. What it does is it will search your list of friends, friends of friends, and other people on Facebook who have made things public for specific bits of information. So, for instance, if I were traveling to Seattle, I could type into the graph search window, friends of my friends who live in Seattle, and up would pop a list of all the people in, all of my friends of friends who live in the city. Maybe they would have recommendations on where I could stay. Maybe they could put me up for a night. I could also type restaurants that my friends in Seattle like, so I can get a little hometown wisdom. But I couldn't just type Belltown restaurants and get a list of restaurants like you would on Google. If you do that, it'll just take you to Microsoft's regular Bing web search.
So is this more than what we usually get if we currently search things on Facebook, or is this an addition to the way we use Facebook?
Yeah, it's more. Facebook's search function, as I think they would even admit, has been pretty much laughably bad for most of Facebook's existence. I don't know if you've ever tried to use it, but you can't find much on there except maybe the names of people. This is a totally new feature that actually has indexed all of the information that's on Facebook and tried to organize it in a way that makes it convenient for you to find out things. It's sort of like a way of taking a poll of everyone you know, or of everyone who lives in a certain place, or seeing everyone who's liked the same TV show that you've liked, or that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I might not want anybody to know those things. So besides my own personal concerns, what are other people's privacy concerns about graph search?
Yeah, exactly. So Facebook has gone to a lot of trouble to make sure that graph search will not take any information that you've set as private and show that to the world at large. So it's not going to change any of your privacy settings. What it does is make things that you have set to public or that you've set to, you know, friends only or friends of friends, and make that a lot easier to find than it is right now. Right now, if I did something on Facebook 4 years ago that I, you know, that might be a little embarrassing, maybe I ironically pressed like on some page out there on the web, there's no way for that to come up in anybody's news feed today. It's pretty much buried. But if that is set to public, then if someone searched using Graph Search in the future, all the people who have liked that distasteful thing, maybe it's some partisan political thing that people find offensive, my name might well come up at the top of the search results. And a lot of people don't want that. And that's why this is the perfect time to go in and adjust your Facebook privacy settings. It's not fun if you've been putting it off. This is the time to get to it before your name starts appearing in lists of search results by friends and even total strangers.
I have noticed on my Facebook page that a little box appeared underneath my home, where you click home, that told me to go look at it. So I couldn't remember, actually. I can't remember what my privacy settings are offhand. And my wall is only visible to my friends. So does that mean that graph search isn't really going to apply to me?
Well, it'll still apply to you in that your friends will be able to search for things about you. So the way that graph search works is each search respects the individual privacy settings of each bit of information that it's looking for. So if one of your friends searches for something and you have that bit of information, say it's an old status update set to friends only, your friend can see that through graph search. But someone who you're not friends with won't be able to see it unless you've set it. That status update to public or friends of friends.
So if people aren't as paranoid as me, what can they do now to, in retrospect, lock down their data?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are like you, actually. They don't know exactly what their privacy settings are. It's funny, Facebook has gone to a lot of trouble in response to all the concerns about privacy to make your privacy settings as customizable as possible. Facebook probably gives you more control over your privacy than any other site on the web, but that's kind of a double-edged sword because it means that you have to actually take the trouble to go through and figure out what your settings are for all these different things. And a lot of people just throw up their hands and say, you know what, I'm just, you know, I'm either not going to post stuff or I'm just going to hope for the best. But really, if you do intend to use Facebook, you should go in and check your settings right now. You can go to a privacy settings page, which I've linked to in the blog post on Slate, or you can find another number of other places. And you can, in one swoop, you can set all of your old posts to friends only. That should prevent them from coming up in strangers' graph searches. And then you can also do things like go through and see all of the photos that you've been tagged in and what the privacy settings of each of those photos is, and you can go through and individually control those. Again, it's a little tedious, but really probably worth it.
Wow, there's a lot of tagging that goes on. One thing that I notice anytime Facebook makes a change is the sort of uproar that happens in my news feed. Nobody ever likes any of the changes, and got me to wondering how much Facebook actually cares what its users think about these changes.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of people at this point have the impression that Facebook just doesn't care. I don't think it's quite that simple. I think, you know, Facebook, they're not stupid. They know that privacy is a big concern and a growing concern for a lot of users. It is true that sort of time after time over the years, they've made a change. People have cried out, promised they're going to quit, and then, of course, they don't. Facebook's user base is still growing. That said, I think, you know, the people that I have talked to at Facebook are very aware that being not trusted by their users is an existential threat to the company's future. They, you know, Mark Zuckerberg may not be a guy who believes in privacy a lot personally. He thinks that everybody should be open and transparent about everything. But I think he and some others at the company have realized over time that not everybody shares that view and that it actually could be pretty dangerous for them to take that approach. So as I said, they've gone to a lot of trouble to make it, you know, to give you all sorts of ways to control your privacy on the site. But I think they may be overestimating people's willingness to actually go in and do that. Not everybody is a tech whiz who is interested in going to three different panels and setting, you know, different settings for every post that they've ever done.
A last question I have for you, Will Oremus, has to do with the in news feeds now. It's as it wasn't a year ago. We now see ads and, you know, so-and-so friend likes such-and-such shoe will come up in mine, for example, because I, you know, clearly they saw sometime that I liked a shoe, and now I get shoe ads. You know, there's just a run of ads. And is graph search an attempt then not only for you to be able to search, you know, what your friends liked or what restaurants, but to be able to somehow insert more ads into this newsfeed?
Yes and no. I don't think they want to insert more ads into the news feed. I think they feel they've heard the backlash, and they feel like cluttering people's feeds with more ads is going to hurt what they call user engagement. That's the amount of time that people spend on the site. And Facebook is very, very concerned about user engagement. They want people coming back again and again and using Facebook and enjoying it and loving it. So they're not going to clutter it up with more ads. What they want to do, and a lot of the features that they've rolled out recently have been geared toward this, they want to do a better job of giving you the right ads, the ads that you might actually be interested in, the ones you might actually click on. And graph search, along with several other things on Facebook, like the new, you know, you can now put hashtags on some posts. All that goes into the work that Facebook is doing to try to get better at showing you the right ads.
It's fascinating. Will Oremus is a staff writer at Slate Magazine, and if you go search him at Slate, you'll find a link to how you can control the privacy settings when it comes to graph search and everything else at Facebook. Thanks for taking time to talk to us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This is KUOW's Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Comedian Hari Kondabolu joins us in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from For Your Eyes Only in Wallingford. Eyewear from independent designers for more than 27 years. Celebrating summer with new styles and fashion sunwear. Open daily, including Sundays, with parking provided. More at foryoureyesonlyoptical.com. Eyewear solutions for work, play, and life.
58 degrees in Seattle, expecting to get up into the low 70s this afternoon, and at least some of the clouds should clear away and leave us partly sunny later. 1017, I'm Bernard Ouellette. Back in the olden, golden days of radio, there was a detective show that featured characters who were not, in fact, detectives. We will investigate in 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Hari Kondabolu's path to comedy wasn't as direct as most performers. It's not every stand-up comedian who has a master's degree from the London School of Economics, in human rights, no less. But these days, Hari Kondabolu seems to be everywhere. He's on television, he's in clubs, he's podcasting, and he's here in the KUOW studios. It's so miraculous. Thank you for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks, Marcy.
You are doing a series of shows at the Comedy Underground, and these are actually, you're using us as guinea pigs here in Seattle, because you're about to go tape a comedy album. Why here? Is it because you have a history living here?
I started in Seattle, and I just trust these audiences. And it's one of those things where I feel like the Seattle audience lets me get away with a ton. Like, I try new material out here whenever I want to bring it back to New York. And so it gets started here and polished later. But I started whenever I do a set on television, I come out here and do the same 7 minutes or 3 minutes or 4 minutes over and over and get it polished. And now I'm recording an album of stuff that the Seattle audience has heard for years. And I'm doing a kind of basically a best of set at the Underground, and people are still showing up. We sold out last night, and it's amazing. I think Seattle, as you know, loves local, supports local. And even though I only lived here for 2 years in my 20s, people still come out, and I love it. And the Seattle audience, it's just special. I think they get it. They're willing to sit through a long setup. My style is a lot of long setups. They like builds. They appreciate the little jokes that other people wouldn't get. It's always magical when I'm here.
Well, that's interesting that we're sort of like the warm shoe, but you're also describing, I mean, the city, I'm not sure if that's good or bad. We're like your bathrobe.
Right. I feel like I'm being so condescending. Well, I come here to work things out, and then I go to the big cities. No, I mean, I love Seattle. Like,
No, that's not actually what I was thinking, more of like, you know, Broadway shows. You're a New Yorker now.
Right, right.
I mean, you were a New Yorker before you came here too, but you're a New Yorker. You live in New York, and Seattle's been a place where Broadway shows lately have come to the Fifth Avenue Theater to work out the kinks out of the eyes of the refined critics or the nasty critics, depending on how you think about them. So is that how it is with these comedy shows?
That's how, in a lot of ways, I feel I trust the Seattle audience because they're both forgiving, but they're critical. Like, you know, I can't just pass off some nonsense and think that they're going to just appreciate anything, you know, but I can take risks here that I wouldn't necessarily take. And I just, something about being here, a joke that I've done for years all of a sudden gets a new life. It gets new punchlines. Mm-hmm. I'm freer here. I'm more comfortable. I develop more material here than I've in any other city. Like, I can't develop in New York the way I develop in Seattle.
What is it? I mean, besides being comfortable, people say this is the rain.
I think that's definitely one of the biggest thing is the comfort. Like, I'm at ease here. It's like I'm talking to friends, even if I know no one in the audience. It feels like I do. And the way I get love when I'm on stage is not like any other city. And it actually makes me second guess my decision to record the album in Oakland. Like, I'm excited because I figured, well, everybody knows my stuff in Seattle already. So if I do it here, it's not going to be as genuine. The laughs are going to be forced. Yet, like, when I did the show last night at the Comedy Underground, we sold out, and it was amazing. I'm like, that could have been the album recording.
And that was the first of five or six. I didn't count.
The first of six.
Of six. I did count correctly. Good. Sometimes I wonder about, you know, how many digits I've got on my hand there.
Yeah.
And you're only doing two shows in Oakland. I mean, you're doing all this this warm-up. Do you actually write this material down? How do you prep for a show?
Well, for this one, it's kind of, this is the course of the last 6 or 7 years. A lot of jokes, again, that started in Seattle. So there's that connection, you know, with wanting to do it here to get it ready. So it's a lot of, you know, these jokes, some of these jokes have never been in this particular order, but I think it would sound good in this order on an album. And so it's building segues, it's adding new jokes that you didn't see before, things like that.
Do you rehearse before you come on stage?
Yeah, still, especially doing something like this, which is a bit more set, you know, it's a lot of like alone in my room repeating things and talking to myself. It's sick. The whole thing is sick. It's very bizarre.
You recently tweeted that you felt like the Bernie Madoff of comedy.
I tweeted that last night.
And that you're always afraid that you're going to be uncovered as a fraud.
I think that's every comic, I think. There's that fear, whether it's an open mic for 3 minutes or an hour set, that this is it. This is the night they find out. It's all been fake and they were going to find me out tonight. You know, it's that fear that makes it exciting still. When you're up there, you still have to impress that audience. And it's been interesting, like, you know, I've been warming up this album for the last couple of weeks, and I think last week I got into a rut where I realized I wasn't performing for the audience in front of me. I was performing for this imaginary audience in Oakland in the future. And I realized I was doing myself and that audience that I was performing for every night a disservice, because they came to see me. Mm-hmm. They don't care about this Oakland audience. They care about having the best show possible and me being engaged with them. And ever since maybe sometime last week, I remembered why I do this.
That's a good thing.
I do this to perform for an audience that's in front of me, not for a recording. And the recording will sound better if I'm alive and they can hear it. And last night's show in Seattle was a great, like, that's what I want to do. It was fun, and it was for people who really wanted to be there.
Well, if it's fun, aren't you funnier?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, it's like being with your friends,
right?
And you're laughing and you're comfortable and you can say whatever, and you know, like, there is a context that's there because we're all friends. And honestly, performing here feels like that. I'm hanging out with a bunch of people that I don't know, but I feel like I've known forever.
Hari Kondabolu is with us, and he's, as you heard, in the midst of a long stand at the Comedy Underground. I don't know if you normally play six nights in a row anywhere.
I usually do.
Do you?
Most runs at comedy clubs are Thursday to Saturday, five shows, but I wanted to add on a Wednesday show, and I feel like my crowd generally comes out on Wednesdays and Thursdays heavily, I think, because the tickets are a little cheaper. It's a lot of students. It's a lot of social workers and activists, and that's my base.
You're the politically correct crowd,
right? I mean, and they're, you know, it's funny though, but they're with me, you know. And I think sometimes people who come to see me, they see the clips online, they go to the comedy club, they don't really know the norms of a comedy club, so there's a lot of, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, I like it, but I don't know what to do. And by the middle, I wear them out. They're like, all right, we can laugh, we're friends now, you get me. But it does take a minute sometimes when a crowd's not used to what stand-up is, and they're not necessarily comfortable with comedy, but they like me, you know.
You know, what stand-up is can span a wide range.
Yeah.
For some odd reason, yesterday we had another comedian on the show, Paula Poundstone.
Oh, my God.
And we were talking about her style. A lot of people know her from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, so you're kind of used to the fact that I believe that she is riffing live as a question hits her from Peter Sagal or whatever. And a lot of it is political or topical. Your material is topical, but I wonder about rehearsing versus being able to be reactive.
Right.
How much is set in stone for you, and how much do you sort of follow wherever your mind takes you?
Well, I very much have a goal there. I've very much seen myself as a writer, and I want to, you know, I have these set pieces that are carefully written and that I've rehearsed and that I really want, you know, like a slight change, it doesn't work. But at the same time, the audience knows when you're phoning it in. They know when you're not completely engaged with them, and they know when it feels like you don't really care who's in front of you. And that's something you can't do. They need to know you care, and they have to feel like this is the first time you've ever said it, even though you've done it for years. And that is part of the trick. My friend W. Kamau Bell, who I write for,
right,
and totally biased, like, you know, Kamau always says, like, a good comedy show feels like a magic trick. It seems like you're seeing magic. How are you making this? How are you pulling laughs out of thin air? And that's what I need to see. It can't be like, well, no, we see the trick. We see the machine. We see how you're doing this. No, it has to feel like this is magic. I can't believe he's making us laugh.
Let's hear a little bit of Hari's magic right now.
I was at this party last week, and this guy came up to me, and he's like, hey, man, where are you from? So I told him, I'm from Queens, New York. Yeah. But wait. And then he's like, no, I mean, where are you really from? Which, for those of you who don't know, that's code for, no, I mean, why aren't you white? I noticed your skin was a different color than mine. Why? Why this? Why? Pigment. Pick. Why? Ethnic. Why this? What kind of animal are you? And I was offended, clearly.
That's Hari Kondabolu. Race, a topic that you address.
Very much so.
People can't see you, but you aren't white. You just mentioned
right,
that.
Right.
So, you know, I guess that links into studying human rights at the London School of Economics. And you were a human rights worker in your 2 years in Seattle. I mean, it was like a serious thing that you did. And it got me to thinking about what is appropriate for comedy. Lindy West, who lives in Seattle,
who's hosted the show last night and will host tonight.
Right. Yeah. Got into some hot water with her fellow comedians by saying, you know, like rape is off limits unless you frame it a certain way. And so, you know, what is the tightrope that you walk when you talk about race or you talk about anything else?
Well, I think Lindy's argument, it was less that rape is off limits, but you can say whatever you want, but then there's an accountability that comes with it, which is true in every part of society, in all art. And I always found it interesting that comedians talk a lot about, like, we don't get respect. That's the classic Rodney Dangerfield, never no respect. And we kind of all feel that. How come we don't get seen as art? How come people heckle us? How come people interrupt us? We're doing a thing, yet once we're criticized, well, it's just a joke. Well, no. Like, being criticized means that people actually are listening to what you say and think it has impact, which we know because we do this for impact, for reactions. So, you know, I think that you can talk about whatever you want to talk about, but there are consequences. And I think, you know, there are different kinds of laughs. You know when people are laughing at a thing or laughing with you and understand. And for me, comedy is about going after painful things and finding ways to kick upward. And, you know, the audience is there for relief a lot of times. Like, they've had a tough week. They're dealing with stuff. And I've always had a tough time, you know, like, as a, you know, as a person in pain, which I think a lot of us are, and we're dealing with pain, and comedy has been my way to do it, I hate the idea of people in pain potentially hurting other people in pain. And that's not what comedy is supposed to be for me.
You know, it's interesting. In theater, to refer back to theater again, people say that they can make a point better in a humorous play than they can in a drama. I mean, sometimes that's not true. There are many Shakespearean plays that make their points pretty well, and you don't laugh. But what is it about laughing at something that allows you to actually feel it or know it?
Oh, I mean, it's catharsis. It's just some of it is the idea of, like, I've been feeling this thing, whatever it is. It doesn't need to be the most serious thing, but if, let's say it is, like some of the, like, prior, Carlin, you say it with the grids, if you were tackling a difficult issue, I've been feeling this thing and I'm not crazy. I've been made to feel crazy that what I believe in these things aren't real, and this comedian is saying it, and people are laughing, acknowledging the truth in it. I must not be crazy. I've been made to feel crazy, and I'm not. I think that's a big part of it, and that laughter for the comedian is like, oh yes, this is great, and for the audience, it's the same thing.
So catharsis, but it's also a sort of universality.
Yeah, that you're not alone.
Yeah,
the idea that you're not alone, and. You know, that also means that when a joke doesn't hit, it's like, oh, I'm alone right now. I am so alone. This is the exact opposite. I'm being told, no, Hari, you are alone right now.
And
we are all
Bernie
staring
Madoff.
At you.
And
right.
You're
the Bernie Madoff of comedy right now.
You mentioned the TV show Totally Biased. So you're writing for your friend.
Yeah.
How is that different than writing material that you do?
Well, it means my jokes tend to be a bit long and you know, they're not always punchy. Like, I have a rhythm to a lot of my stuff. The joke for me is in the setup and in the explanation. I love that. I love the deconstruction of a joke. And Kamauda has a different style, so it's adjusting to that style. And his points of view are very close to mine. And that's one great privilege of writing for your friend. But we're not always going to be the same. So it's a matter of, like, making sure you write in a way that he can deliver it. And also, it's television, so it has to be punchier. It has to be quicker. And we do have the privilege of images and putting video and things that a stand-up has to do in words. I will say one great privilege of writing for W. Kamau Bell is that if he can't say something, or if it's a point of view that doesn't quite work for him but he thinks you can do it, he'll just put you on. Very few hosts will be like, you know what, I can't do this, why don't you be on television and do it on my show? And, you know, I've asked him, like, why do you do this? It's an incredible thing. And he says, well, Jack Benny used to be asked that question, like, are you okay with everyone else getting the punchlines? And he's like, no, because when people talk about the show, they're like, did you guys see Jack Benny last night?
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone's going to talk about, did you see that in Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell last night? I mean, he's incredibly open performer. He's somebody who's very, like, he's about sharing the ball. It's incredible.
The show is weekly right now. It's going nightly?
It's going nightly. We're going to be 5 days a week, Monday to Thursday, in a special Sunday show, which is the best of the week, starting in September.
Now, as you're talking, I'm picturing sort of comedy shows through the ages. Right now, the shows that people are writing for daily are those sort of late night shows with the guys who host them all, because it's always guys.
Right.
But I'm thinking back to, like, Sid Caesar, your show of shows, and some of the, actually I'm thinking of the Dick Van Dyke Show on TV, which was about the Sid Caesar show. But folks like Woody Allen got their start. I think Neil Simon also got a start writing jokes for other people. And at some point, I would imagine that's, you know, there's a point where your ego would take over. I don't know.
Well, I mean, part of it is... you know, one, he lets us be on the air, so it's like it's
oh,
an
so
amazing.
You're okay.
Yeah, we get to still have like
okay, Hari, good job.
I did a piece at the Steampunk World's Fair that's going to air in the fall. It was such a strange and amazing.
Wait,
thing.
Is that a real thing?
That's a real thing in I believe it was Piscataway, New Jersey, at a Radisson. So like, I mean, it was an incredible experience, and I told him I got invited to do this thing, and he's like, all right, let's film it. You know, like it's that kind of like guerrilla, like let's just do this. And And so everyone gets a piece of it, and that's one of our responsibilities. You're supposed to write for yourself. You have an interesting point of view, and we want you to share it on our program.
I just have to take a little tangent here. What's the Steampunk World's Fair?
Oh my God, it was a treat. Are you familiar with steampunk?
Yeah,
it's like, you know, the kind of the dressing kind of Victorian era, but like it has a science fictiony feel, you know, like Jules Verne, and so you can there's a lot of clocks and sprockets and things of that, and top hats, and it's, you know.
Did you have to go in that same costume?
Initially, I didn't, but when I did the show, and this is a bit of a spoiler, but like you know, I did put on a Sherlock Holmes. I called it my Sherlock Homeboy outfit at the end. Of the piece. We haven't edited it yet, so we don't know what it's going to look like, but it was delightful. And it was fascinating to talk to people about history and how they saw it. And to some people, like, you know, race and colonialism were not part of the picture, even though in the Victorian era, that was an issue. That was there. Not all of us could just walk around freely and do what we wanted to do. And it was interesting to some people, especially to talk to people of color there. And to them, it's like, well, to them, it was a reimagining of the time period, and it was a way to talk about those things and kind of shape a new future using the past, which is fascinating. So I really loved the experience, and I can't wait for that piece to be on air.
Well, so that's something to look forward to, and
absolutely.
I'm still trying to imagine a steampunk World's Fair, but whatever. You also do an improv podcast with your brother.
Yeah.
And I confess I didn't really know that you had a funny brother.
Oh, he's much funnier than I am.
Well, how
there's no doubt.
So you just, I mean, I saw a clip and it looked like you two just get up and talk.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we do a live show called the Untitled Kundabula Brothers Project, which we've done in Seattle. But we have a podcast called the Untitled Kundabula Brothers Podcast, and it's the most comfortable thing in the world.
Because it's your brother.
It's my brother. It's not that hard to do in a lot of ways, you know? And we're very different person. I mean, there's obviously some core that's similar because we were raised, you know, by the same parents, and we were in the same house, and we were very close. But, like, you know, I feel like I'm reeling him in a lot, you know? That I'm that character. Like
You're the big brother.
I'm the big brother. Oh, clearly. I'm very much the big brother. And he's also, he was a performer. He was in a hip-hop group called Das Racist that, you know, traveled all over the world, has a very interesting but brief career, and he talks a lot about like adventures and stories and, you know, very interesting interactions from all over the world. And, you know, we have a very unique point of view as two South Asian brothers who grew up in Queens, who have had the privilege of having unconventional careers and have traveled all over the world. And so the podcast is so much fun. And I'm doing it with somebody like our rhythms are so natural. And even when the show and the podcast was not particularly good, and we could admit that, and we didn't really know what we were doing, the one thing we would hear is, this is going to be good because the chemistry is there. That's the one thing we had, is it was easy to go back and forth. And as we've tightened the format, it's gotten a lot more, you know, a lot more fun for the audience.
You ever wake up in the morning and think, gosh, there's just really nothing funny going on?
Oh, yeah. I'm a human. I mean, like, yeah, all you got to do is read the – I mean, look, I'm an NPR listener. Like, yeah, it's bad out there. But, you know, but that's, again, why comedy is incredible. I have such an incredible job. I can take that pain and hopefully find something funny that we can laugh at out of it. And and sometimes you can't, but you do the best you can to laugh. And sometimes I might not talk about the most painful thing in the world that is happening right now, but you go to the comedy club and maybe you laugh at something else to take your mind off it. And, you know, I love this art form. And, it's one of the great American art forms, stand-up comedy, and we don't always talk about it, but, like, it's incredible. And so many of my fans tell me stuff like, you know, I just didn't trust comedy. I don't love comedy. I think comedy is a place that can be so oppressive. But it's like, comedy doesn't need to be that. There may be comedians that you don't like, but comedy, don't blame comedy for this. Comedy is a liberating thing. For me, it's given me everything. Like, I want people, like, if you feel that you don't like comedy, that the comedy you've seen it bothers you, don't complain about it. Do it. Write. Create. Like, comedy is open to everybody. And it's not always the most open place. And I get sometimes it's very, like, straight male dominated, you know, and I'm a straight male and I can understand that. But I will say that, like, there is a place. And in Seattle especially, like, our audiences are a lot better than a lot of other places in the country. There's an openness that we have here that I find it allowed me to be the comic I am today, starting here.
You're still using our and we.
Yeah, I know.
So you still feel that little...
It's strange. I grew up in Queens. I live in Brooklyn. Like, but there's such a... I have a weird connection to the city. I'm obsessed with the city. Like, there was a show... I think LOL Work that was, like, on Bravo. It was only on for, like, 6 episodes. And I knew it, and I was kind of starstruck by the people that have been on it, because it's like, I know, like, all these Seattle things. Like, I wasn't around for Almost Live, but I know what the John Report is. You know what I mean? like it wasn't even my time period, but I wasn't even here, and I'm still kind of, I've had this weird obsession with this city. I love it so much. All my best friends are here. It's magical.
So, instead of feeling like the bridesmaid while Oakland is the bride, when you go to record that album down there,
yeah,
you know, can you look ahead past that one and imagine some time where something big like that happens here?
Oh, I think, I mean, I always thought my first album would be in Seattle. And the choice to do Oakland, part of it is that this venue in Oakland, the New Parish, I've just had some incredible shows there and I just have such a great feeling. But I'm like, I think it's supposed to be here. I just have the feeling. But yeah, there's a lot of guilt now, like, especially after the show last night. Like, maybe I should have done it here. So everyone's so wonderful and they're so excited. And, you know, see, again, like, Seattle audiences, if you have any connection to the city, they are so loyal to you. There is such a love. And they remember when I started. They remember when I was just figuring it out. And there are people that have been here since 2005 and they still come to the shows.
So, Hari, you're on TV, you're podcasting, you're writing, you're performing, you're recording an album. Like, yeah, what's the top of the mountain for you?
Oh, I don't know. Who knows, right? Like, no one ever knows. I mean, I think it's a privilege to have health insurance. Like, I'm psyched about the health insurance. I mean, if I can maintain health insurance for the rest of my life, I think I've made it in America, right?
Isn't that what you and 300 million other Americans would feel the same way?
I think that's what being successful in America is. Being successful in America is having health care. It's unfortunate, but that is the truth. And I have health care, so I've made it.
Hari Kondabolu has health care, so he's successful. And you can see him performing all through the weekend, 5 more shows at Comedy Underground in Seattle as he gets ready for that other city down south. Thanks for coming in today. It's
absolutely
been a pleasure.
Absolutely, and the album will be out on Kill Rock Stars, a Northwest label, next year.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
.10:39, and we're warming up the radio time machine, heading back to the golden age of radio in a minute.
KUOW thanks the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
Carrying the responsibility of workers' rights in Bangladesh, on the clothes on our backs, here in the United States.
Anywhere in the world, the standard should be that that hard day of work shouldn't end up in the potential of losing your life.
Senator Robert Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, on how to improve conditions in the garment factories of Bangladesh and around the world. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the law firm of Riddell Williams, providing legal representation and strategic thinking to achieve business objectives. Riddell Williams, aligned with business.
1041, I'm Bernard Ouellette. You know what would save a lot of time when you're hungry? A cookbook that you can eat. Until we have that, though, we have local food writer Sarah Dickerman. She offers us choices. She'll recommend a cookbook and a place to eat in 15 minutes. But first, shh.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
The inner tubes now send old-time radio right back into your home through the magic of the internets. And because of that, we've been exploring old-time radio, getting a sense of what it was people were listening to and why in the 30s and 40s and 50s, where there was a time when radio was, as you know, the center of the living room or the kitchen, and people would huddle around it. And one of the shows they huddled around was a show, Katie Sewell, that I had never heard of, called Rocky Jordan. Had you ever heard of Rocky Jordan?
Mainly because you've become obsessed with it in the last few months.
I have become obsessed with it because, as I've told you folks, archive.org, you can go there. They are a nonprofit that decided that they would amass all the information of the internet and save it in one place. And so they are amassing all these old-time radio shows as well as much more. And so, yeah, you can go there and listen to your heart's content to all these shows. So I came across Rocky Jordan because, I don't know, Rocky and Jordan.
You were looking for something a little on the edge?
I guess so. And it was such an odd thing to listen to. And it is dated, I will admit, but it's not so bad. Of a character, this mysterious American who is in, first he's in Istanbul and later he's based in Cairo. And he's sort of like Rick in Casablanca. He runs this cafe where things happen.
Well, people think it's actually based off of Casablanca.
I'm sure it was.
Well, let's hear the intro to see, get the flavor of Rocky Jordan.
Time now for Rocky Jordan. Not far from the Mosque Sultan Hassan in Cairo stands the Cafe Tambourine, run by Rocky Jordan. The Cafe Tambourine, crowded with forgotten men, alive with the babble of many languages. For this is Cairo, where modern adventure and intrigue unfold against a backdrop of antiquity.
I love it. I actually love how... There's a book called On the Air, which is an encyclopedia of all this old-time radio stuff, written by John Dunning. And I love how he describes Rocky Jordan. He describes him as, quote, a rugged hero who each week was confronted by a crime, a mystery, a beautiful woman, or a combination of all three.
The thing about Rocky Jordan is, and I think what attracted me to him, is he is one prickly dude. He is not a hero in the typical sense. He is anti-hero like you would expect in the 40s and 50s. He is short with people. Customers come in and he says, "Hey, watch it, bub," and, you know, "What do you want?" He's not nice. And I think that's an interesting thing. And he's this American interacting with all these often stereotypical, but not always stereotypical, people from Cairo and before that from Istanbul. But, you know, and there's a little bit of that. It can be a little bit discomforting. But there's enough powerful and positive characters, and there is a respect shown to the culture. So the captain, the police captain, Sam Sabaya, he is, though, of course, played by, you know, an American. But he is, you know, treated with respect. The other characters are mostly treated with respect. The power structure is mostly treated with respect. So it's interesting to hear this other culture come into American homes. We don't have that very much in modern television.
Well, and it was considered actually one of the standout shows of the time for its setting. They worked really hard to try to get the street names in Cairo right, to have the music sort of reflect the music that they were hearing from there at the time. So in that way, it was unique in its setting. You keep mentioning that it was actually set in Istanbul, and that was like its preliminary try as a show. Like 3 years before it actually became Rocky Jordan, it was called A Man Named Jordan, and it took place in Istanbul rather than Cairo. I did not find out why they decided to move it.
Istanbul's pretty exotic.
Yeah, but let's hear what it sounded like when it was A Man Called Jordan.
In those places in this world where intrigue and danger go hand in hand, where death and disaster are the rewards of weakness, in such places will be found
a man named Jordan.
That's kind of overwrought.
I love that death and disaster are the rewards of weakness.
But the music is pretty great, because the music is interesting to listen to. And, you know, there were real musicians that were at one time recording it live, playing it live, rather, I mean, for the program before it went to transcription later in the...
Absolutely were. And two people played him.
Yeah.
People played Rocky Jordan. The only one that people really like was the main Rocky Jordan.
Jack Moyles, the guy we've heard.
Yeah, and he was on during the run of the show. The show actually only ran for 2 years. So he was during the run of the show, and they tried to bring it back with movie star Jack Raft.
George Raft.
I'm sorry, George Raft. During the summer of 51, and then it was quickly gone, I think, because nobody liked George. But since you like Jack playing Rocky so much, I think we should listen to him.
Yeah, because he's better.
It was the other side of midnight, and I was beginning to think I'd spent one of those routine days I could forget. That just goes to show how wrong you can be. The customers and the help had gone, and I walked over to the front door to let a little air in before I locked up for the night. I got the air all right, but I also got something I wasn't counting on.
Mrs. Jordan. Mrs. Jordan.
She moved in out of the shadows like she'd been waiting there. She was inside like a magazine salesman. But she didn't look the part. She was small and dark, but all woman, with eyes a little too big for her face.
Monsieur Jordan, you do not remember me?
Well, give me time. It'll come to me.
I was a manicurist.
Sure, manicurist at Shepherd's.
Oui.
Adele, wasn't it?
Adele Simonon. Monsieur Jordan, I had to see you.
And the light's better in the daytime.
No, this had to be tonight. I'm asking you, please, to do something for me. It will not be difficult.
Who ever heard that before?
The light's better in the daytime.
That's from an episode called Smokescreen, if anyone wants to actually hear what she needs.
Well, you said, why are they always French? Because French is cool. That's exotic. They're not all French, though.
They're just throwing in random characters that are exotic, basically, to the show.
That's what they want to make it interesting. So I said that Jay Novello, he played Captain Sam Sabaya for both versions of the show. And here's a little bit of what he was like as the police captain of Cairo.
Sam and I went in. Mrs. Grotman was standing behind the counter, a small, thin woman with dark skin and sunken cheeks. Sam introduced himself. It was his party, so I let him carry the ball.
Mrs. Grotman, I'm afraid that I have sad news for you.
Sad news, good Captain Sabaya, is not far into me.
Your husband, Mrs. Grotman, is dead.
Didn't you hear, Mrs. Grotman? Emil's dead.
I heard the good captain.
You do not seem surprised at the news.
Perhaps that is because I am not.
Look, I found him in Hassan's steam room. He was murdered.
Thank you for telling me. I shall make any arrangements necessary for the funeral.
You indicate very little feeling for your husband.
Does it seem so to you?
Mrs. Grotman, I suggest that you make arrangements to close your shop and appear at headquarters as soon as possible. I have many questions to ask you.
As you wish, Captain.
Come along, Jordan.
I'll see you later, Sam. I want to buy some tobacco.
Oh, he's buying some tobacco.
No, he's staying around to pump some information out of that unsad widow.
Yeah, he wants some more information. I think that as we explore this over the next few weeks, I think what's interesting about this era versus the modern radio dramas you listen to is the acting. And the acting seems to me, I wonder what other people think, just more natural.
Well, more natural.
Though that one maybe stood out for a little bit not being natural, but a little more natural.
Well, I think in some ways, and yeah, we should definitely continue to explore it. I think in some ways it's because it's what people were trained to do. It's what it meant to be an actor. Whereas now a lot of the training is either for the theater, so being big, bold in your emotions, or being very refined in your emotions because it's for the screen. And this is, everything has to come through your voice. Everything.
Yeah, it is very interesting about that. You know, and we do, so we have a few folks on Facebook. My husband likes Boston Blackie, among others. Michael writes, the old Mystery Theater is one of my favorites, and I love them all. And we try to attend the live tapings in Kirkland when we can. He's talking about what Jim French is still doing, right?
Yep.
With his radio.
The Imagination Theater.
Yeah, and then Felix Bunnell is doing those shows that he did at Town Hall, the holiday shows with actors.
It's a Wonderful Life, etc.
And people keeping it alive. The Great Gildersleeve, Lane writes, and Lanigan versus the Ants and the three Skeleton Key episodes of Escape that were amazing examples of radio storytelling. Also like X-1.
Well, before we end, really quick, one of the things I love about Rocky Jordan is that it's a detective show that is not using a detective as the main character. And what happened, you see this a lot actually during the era, is detective shows became like one of the most popular genres. And you had everybody from, you know, Sherlock Holmes to Richard Diamond on. And so they started doing a whole other genre of all these people who were detectives but actually weren't in their day jobs, like Rocky Jordan, who he just owns a cafe and, oh my gosh, all of a sudden he's solving crime. And so I put together a little montage of, you know, a couple others where they have a day job that has nothing to do with being a detective.
Yeah, folks we're going to talk about in the weeks ahead. I don't know, Katie, you and I live like that. We're going to solve crimes.
That's right.
NBC presents Frank Sinatra, starring as that footloose and frequently unemployed young gentleman, Rocky Fortune.
Out of a big city's roaring life, out of a great newspaper's pounding heart, come the exciting adventures of a man with a camera, Flash Gun Casey, press photographer.
Box 13. Rain, rain, rain. I'll bet even the ducks wouldn't come out in weather like this. But me, I'm an idiot. I gotta go and take up a profession like being a writer.
Bold venture.
I didn't want to go. You wanted to go.
All right. And Mr. Scon and whatever he wanted us to bring to Havana weren't there. But we had a boat ride to Key West and back. What are you angry about? The money we didn't make?
No, it was time away from Havana. But I didn't have to be away from her.
You talk about Havana like it was a woman. How do you talk about me behind my back?
Walk ahead of me and I'll think of something.
Sorry, I had to put that in at the end.
I think what's amazing about all that is that, so Rocky Fortune, that's Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
And then Alan Ladd was Box 13, and that's Bogart and Bacall in Bold Venture.
Yeah, Bold Venture, them being a boat owner for hire.
Hey,
you know, whatever it takes to make money.
Yeah.
But I had to put that last comment in just because I found it amusing.
Jumping out.
I find the two of them very amusing.
And it's a very weird show.
It is.
Talk about strange writing. They sort of have this sense of, I don't know, there's that playfulness that they brought to Have and Have Not. But at the same time, there's, I don't know, again, it's this notion of these people being very, they're not heroes, you know? They're kind of bitter. They're kind of edgy. They're not all, like the 70s, a lot of the characters in TV shows in the 70s and 80s were pretty positive. You know, they didn't have much edge to them, even like.
Yeah, I don't think Rocky Fortune, Frank Sinatra's Rocky Fortune, he's not a very good character, and neither is Bogart in Bold Venture.
I mean, they're not, yeah,
they're not real upstanding citizens.
Yeah, they do a few things.
Mm-hmm.
But Rocky Fortune, at least, he was somebody who tried to
get a job.
Get a job. Yeah, he was just trying to get a job. This is Weekday. Talk to you on the radio.
Bye, Steve.
So retro there, Bernard. Like it a lot. It's Thursday, and it's time to check in once again with food writer extraordinaire Sarah Dickerman. It's been a couple weeks, Sarah. I hope you had a good 4th of July.
I did, yes. We had good barbecue for lunch that day.
But we're not going to talk about barbecue.
No, I'm going to send you over for some steamy delights in Bellevue to Din Tai Fung, which is a, many people know, but it's a very well-known chain of Chinese dumpling houses, and the first one in the Northwest landed in Bellevue, and we're actually soon going to have one in University Village.
I am looking forward to that because I have not yet made the trek to Bellevue. What is, for folks who haven't had the, like myself, who haven't had the good fortune, what is a Chinese dumpling?
Oh, there's, of course, as many dumplings as there are regions in China, of course. But you know, it's a little wrapper wrapped around something, a little doughy wrapper wrapped around something delicious. They can actually be pan-fried as well, but I'd say the specialty at Din Tai Fung is steamed dumplings, and including juicy dumplings, which are sometimes called soup dumplings, which have a little bit of broth inside them. So when you bite into them, they're really extraordinarily juicy. And that's really something you should order if you go. You can also get shumai, which are the sort of slightly open dumplings that often have shrimp in them. And I always like to order the wontons, which are sort of more a thinner skin twist, and they serve them marinated. And those are quite wonderful at Din Tai Fung, too. And also, if you're constructing a meal around all this sort of pasta-like stuff, remember to order some greens. They do delicious greens, and they really balance out the meal.
Sarah, how is this different from the dim sum restaurants that many people are familiar with?
This one has a little bit more focus, and you get to watch the dumplings being made. Not many dim sum restaurants make their own dumplings. Sometimes they don't. And so there's a little bit of fun theater to watching dumplings get made. They're wonderfully little pinched dough creations. And then it's not a giant menu. It's big, but it doesn't go all over the place and all over to different parts of the country. It's mostly the dumplings and the greens and a few appetizers and stuff, but there's a real focus on these particular dumplings.
Well, that's the restaurant Din Tai Fung, but we're not going to talk about Chinese cooking.
Oh, for
your book, yes.
Yeah, no, I'm all over the place today. I guess I'm enjoying our global existence.
Good.
And I wanted to recommend a book called The New Food of Life, which is, I will have a hard time pronouncing her name, but it's Najmia Batmanglish, who's actually the mother of one of the guys in Vampire Weekend.
Okay.
And she wrote a while ago now this incredible book on Persian cookery, which is just so full of information on one of the really great cuisines of the world that also, you know, tracks into Middle Eastern, Eastern Mediterranean, and Indian, even Indian cooking. You see tendrils of these flavors. It's a kind of cuisine that has lots of beautiful vegetables, fresh herbs, and fruits worked into things. One of the famous dishes is a chicken or duck in a pomegranate walnut sauce.
Mm.
It's absolutely incredible. But I was thinking for summer, one of the lovely things you can do in Persian cookery is they have these sort of frittata-like omelets called kukus, and one that is filled with herb is called the kuku yes sabzi, which is just filled with herbs, and it's just a very, very green frittata and just a perfect summer lunch or appetizer.
Yum.
So I recommend checking out this book, which is also filled with poetry and photographs.
The book is called New Food of Life. The restaurant is Din Tai Fung, and the recommender is Sarah Dickerman. She writes about food at her website, sarahdickerman.com. You can find her on Twitter, at Sarah Dickerman, and all sorts of publications from Bon Appetit to Slate. And thanks for joining us every Thursday, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell with Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is back at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, international soccer star Megan Rapinoe will be in our studios, plus your take on the news. Hope you can join us then.
A United Nations Human Rights Panel wants information from the Vatican regarding child sex abuse by priests. That and more of the day's news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington Energy Services, featuring energy-efficient products since 1957 to fit individual home, lifestyle, and budget. Windows, heating and cooling systems, water heaters, and more. Products, installation, and service information online at washingtonenergy.com.
urban gangs have something in common with the Taliban.
The business model is the same. It's the same business model. And I know counterinsurgency can work if properly applied.
Counterinsurgency has had mixed results in Afghanistan, but it's winning back a neighborhood in Massachusetts. Military strategy defeats street violence next time on The World.
That's later. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.